I had the feeling that I'd come from nowhere. Just a mother and a father, nothing else, no history, no family, no nothing. In a way, I inherited the silence of my father.
I had to play against the silence. How British clarinetist Stephen Sade speaks about the fate of his Jewish family and gives them a voice again through his book Play the Silence. A very warm welcome to a new episode of Kultur im Ohr. I'm Viola Gräfenstein, journalist and lover of culture. Those who know me are aware that I like to stand up for justice and for inspiring people with big hearts. That's why my podcast, Kultur im Ohr, introduces extraordinary individuals who make the world a better place through who they are, their ideas, and their actions. In this episode, I'm joined by Stephen Sade from Paris. Stephen was born in London 82 years ago. He is a musician, retired lecturer, and translator who has learned a great deal about life, yet for a long time, he never truly knew who he was or who his family really were. The reason? A large part of his family was murdered in Auschwitz. His father, who survived the Holocaust, remained silent about it for the rest of his life, leaving his son in the dark. But some time ago, Stephen Sade's past caught up with him. During a walk along the banks of the Rhine, Jutta Ermecke from Mettmann happened to find a small metal plate in the sand. After some investigation, it turned out to be the signature stamp of his Jewish grandmother, Martha Sade, who had lived as an artist in Langenfeld-Immichrath in the Rhineland between Cologne and Düsseldorf in Germany. In 1944, she, her husband Hugo Sade, and their daughter Ursula were murdered by the Nazis in Auschwitz. Only the son survived in London. Some time ago, I had the opportunity to visit the grandchild, Stephen Sade, in his adopted home of Paris and personally show him his grandmother's signature stamp. It is the only remaining object he has of her. I spoke with him about his grandmother, about what it was like to grow up as a Jewish descendant, unable and not allowed to speak about this part of his past, and about how the silence surrounding the Holocaust shaped and dominated his own life. Today, he has written a book about his Jewish family, Play the Silence, in which he retraces his family's footsteps and comes to terms with feelings of guilt. For him, the silence about his family's origins and the guilt inherited from his father for being the only family survivor should never again define his life. By writing this book, I celebrated my family's life instead of focusing on their death, something that had led me to see and define myself as a victim for many years. I wanted to give my family a voice because I celebrate life. That has also set me free, says Stephen Sade. I'm very pleased to have Stephen Sade on my podcast, Kultur im Ohr. Thank you for listening, and thank you for allowing me to contribute through Stephen Sade's story to keeping the memory of Jewish families alive.
I belong to a poetry club where I play my clarinet, but also I read poetry, and very often I choose something by Shakespeare, either something from one of the plays or a sonnet or whatever. But Shakespeare is one of my real heroes.
Why do you like him so much?
Because of the universality of his work. And because of the language that he uses, Shakespeare has this incredible ability to encapsulate a complicated idea in three words. And that is incredible. But I did play my clarinet on the boat that I worked on. You see, I worked on a boat in Paris. And I would tell the passengers that in the underground part of the canal, which is 2 kilometres, that if they listen carefully, they might hear the ghost who plays the clarinet in the tunnel. And then I would play my clarinet, but they couldn't see me. At least they couldn't see me at first. So I did all kinds of things like that. And I told a lot of stories, often crazy stories. I tried to be, well, I liked very much to introduce humour, even when I'm talking about tragedy.
You're holding this signature plate in your hands.
Yes.
What do you feel when you see it?
It's like touching the past. I feel overwhelmed because not only did I know nothing about my father's family, but I didn't inherit anything because everything was spoliated, everything disappeared. So the fact that this object that belonged to my grandmother, Marta Zadi, is very, very moving. It's very moving for me to hold it, to look at it. It's because it's like a link to all those things that I didn't know about, all that history that was so elusive because my father could not talk about these things. So, yes, and it's extraordinary that this came up for me after having written the book. Now, I thought, that's it. I've written my book. The story's there. It's done. And then I get an email from a lady called Viola who tells me she has something that belonged to my grandmother. I didn't understand. At first, I thought she was talking about Stolpersteiner or something. So the fact that somebody was walking along the Rhine and saw this thing and picked it up and then kept it, I think, for 4 years, and then met somebody who knew somebody about who was interested in the history of Jews from this part of Germany, and that person was the person who gave me a lot of help at the beginning of my writing project. So it's really extraordinary. When I think about it, I find it hard to believe that this is all happening. But yes, it's wonderful.
It's like she's talking to you and now you have got something of her.
Yes, yes. And the first time she spoke to me was when I went to Auschwitz, and I went into one of the huts in Birkenau. I had 3 small stones which I wanted to leave.
It's a Jewish tradition, right?
It's a Jewish tradition. They don't put flowers on graves. They leave stones. So in a way, I was treating Birkenau as a grave, and I was all by myself because it was very, very cold. It was minus 18 or something. And so there were no visitors. And as you probably know, Birkenau is not like Auschwitz I. Auschwitz I has become a museum. Birkenau was left to go to ruin. And personally, I find that ruins are much more eloquent than museums. And being there in Birkenau, being in this hut, freezing cold, I began to talk to the family I had never known. I said, Hugo, Martha, this is extraordinary to be here. And I told them that I was alive. And I told them that was important and that I thought about them a lot. So there was, in a strange way, I don't believe in ghosts, I don't believe in phantoms, but I do believe that I was in communication with my dead grandparents, and that was at Auschwitz. So that was a kind of conversation. And having the signature plate is another conversation. So these things are important. They matter very much. It's a way of recuperating, not even recuperating, because I never had this. It wasn't something I'd lost. It was something that I never knew. I wasn't allowed to know. So yes, very important.
You are not allowed to know? What do you mean exactly?
I mean that there was a taboo in the family that we did not talk about Nazi Germany. We did not talk about Germany from 1933 to 1939. It was an unwritten law. Nobody said to me, we don't talk about these things, but children are very perceptive. And I knew that somehow this was a subject that I was not allowed to know about, but it was very difficult. I, with hindsight, can understand that my father was starting a new life in England, and he wanted the old life to be the past and finished, and we don't talk about that, and, you know, the new life. But the problem for a child is that he perhaps needs to be nourished in some ways by the past. It's very important. And I had the feeling that I'd come from nowhere because I knew nothing. The only family I had was a mother and a father, no brothers, no sisters, no cousins, no aunts, though I did discover I had cousins later on, but I was already 21. So, yes, the silence was imposed. And if the book is called Play the Silence, it's a reference to silence in music, in the way that we talk about space in relationship to sculpture, for example, but it's also a reference to the silence of my father, who was quite incapable of talking about these things.
Why did you write the book, and why did you call it Play the Silence?
Why did I write the book? I could maybe speak for 4 or 5 hours about why I wrote the book.
For 8 years, right?
It took me 8 years, yes, yeah. It would not have been possible for me to write this book when my father was still alive. I think it needed, for me, you know, I needed to be in a different space where I might feel guilty towards the dead, but at least I wouldn't be feeling guilty towards the living, because writing the book I knew was a transgression. To write the book, I had to do research. I had to go to Auschwitz. I had to go to Łódź in Poland, where my father's family was in the ghetto. And so I was embarking on a project which was in direct contravention to the taboo that I'd known all my life. And there is a strange phenomenon which involves transferring guilt from one person to another. And my father was, he tried desperately to get his family to England between 1938 and 1939. And
you mean your grandparents?
Yeah, he wanted to bring his sister, Ursula, Martha and Hugo to England, but in order to do that, at least one of them would have to have a work permit.
And this was very difficult to get a work permit?
Well, my grandfather, as you know, was a doctor, and there was apparently somebody in the Samuel family. Salomon Samuel was the rabbi of Essen, but he was a close friend of my grandfather, Hugo Zadi. And my father discovered that there was somebody from the Samuel family who had a position in a pharmacy chain, Boots, very big English chemist shop. And he went to see this person and explained the situation, but the Samuel person said, no, there's nothing I can do, I'm sorry. So my father tried through the refugee channels and so on. But in the end, war broke out and there was no more communication, or very little communication, between my father and his family. So when I talk about the transmission of guilt, the guilt that my father felt, why me? You know, why should I survive? And why should I be the only one? And he felt guilty because he did not manage to get the other three members of his family into safety. But it wasn't his fault, obviously. But, you know, guilt is rarely a rational thing.
Is that the reason why he never talked about it? Because he felt, like, very guilty?
That was certainly a very big part of it, yes. And there's also, of course, and this is such a common thing, so many, many, many human beings feel this pain when they lose their family through napalm in Vietnam, through whatever, and in this case, the gas chambers of Birkenau. So it's this terrible pain that he must have felt and that he couldn't deal with. And in the 1940s and 1950s, we didn't talk about post-traumatic disorder. You were just left to fend for yourself. So he wasn't able to do that. So what did he do? He closed up and he became a very secretive man.
Did this have a certain impact on you and maybe also on your mother that he closed up?
Of course. The impact on my mother is, it's difficult to know exactly how she felt about this, because when I talked about my father with my mother, and I said, yes, but we mustn't forget how much he suffered. And she said, yes, but so did everybody else. That's no reason, and so on. And my mother was a very outgoing person. She was very funny. She had a wonderful laugh. She was the life and soul of whatever party was going on. I think that the marriage between my parents soured very much, especially when they left London, where my mother at least had her artist friends and so on. As far as I'm concerned, the effect of my father's silence was catastrophic, in a way, because I always felt there was something missing, something that I had to have, and I didn't know what it was.
You said that you felt really lonely, like you didn't know anything about your family. You felt like a single person without any relatives, right?
Well, I felt, yes. I had the feeling, though I probably, as a child, wouldn't have expressed it in the same way, but I had the feeling that I'd come from nowhere. Just a mother and a father, nothing else, no history, no family, no nothing. And without being able to explain, because at that age, I think you don't think of psychological explanations, obviously. But in a way, I inherited the silence of my father. I found conversation very difficult. I found learning very difficult, because I was very much aware that I didn't have the right to know. And that affected my life in so many different ways. But the wonderful thing, because I think it's very important to talk about the wonderful things as well, the wonderful thing is that I managed to bring this family that I never knew to life, and I stopped thinking of myself as being Jewish because of Auschwitz. That is to say, because of the death in the gas chambers of Ursula, Martha, and Hugo. And
this is your family, right? Ursula is your...
Ursula was my aunt. Hugo and Martha were my father's parents. That by writing, by taking on this project, I suddenly realized that I was celebrating their lives rather than focusing on their deaths. And that was so important.
Let's come to Langenfeld. This is the town where your grandparents lived, and they were very well known there. I mean, your grandfather was a famous doctor, one could say, for children. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about this family. What do you know about them?
Well, it wasn't called Langenfeld in those days. It was called Immichat. And Immichat, I think, got swallowed up by Langenfeld. But my grandfather, Hugo, was a doctor. He was in the German army in the First World War, and he was awarded the Iron Cross.
He fought for Germany, right?
Well, he wasn't fighting. He was working as a doctor. But it's just as important, I suppose. I mean, personally, I'm against warfare of any kind. But that's another subject, isn't it? So he set up his practice in Immichat. And I think one of the reasons that they chose Immichat Langenfeld was because it was close to big towns like Cologne. So there were art galleries. My grandfather was a great music lover. And that's a link for me as well.
Your grandmother studied art in Düsseldorf, right?
My grandmother was an artist, yes. She painted, she sculpted. She did a statue of the mayor of Langenfeld. Was it Langenfeld or?
Mm-hmm.
No, Richard, I can't remember.
Metzmacher,
yes, that's right, the mayor. She did a portrait of which I would have loved to see, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So she was an artist. And I think they had an extremely rich life. The friends, the people that came to see them were all such interesting people. There was the Rabbi Samuel, the Rabbi of Essen, who was an astonishing man, who said that if you have the choice, well, not exactly the choice, but if you're dying and the only way you can survive is to eat pork, will you eat pork, you know? And it's one thing I like about the Jewish religion is that there are many rabbis that don't actually believe in God. And I don't know if that was the case for the Rabbi Samuel.
And he has got a very famous brother-in-law, I think, the philosopher.
Yes, Salmon Friedlander. He was known as Minona, which is anonymous backwards, and he was very interested in the philosophy of Kant, and he wrote a book called Kant for Kinder. Kant for children.
In Berlin, yes.
That's right, yes. So he was busy writing. He wasn't making any money. And my grandfather gave him free medical treatment, but also gave him money. There was obviously a very close bond between the two men. And I eventually met a German publisher, editor, called Hartmut Gierken, because in the information that I managed to get about my family, there were often references in brackets, see Hartmut Gierken editor. So I Googled Hartmut Gierken and found an email address. And he was delighted to be in touch with the grandson of Hugo Zade. And he was completely infatuated with the work of Friedlander Meinona, and was editing the complete works. That's 24 big volumes. It's a huge enterprise. So there was a kind of intellectual brother sisterhood around the house in Immichat.
Solingerstraße?
In Solingerstraße, which I visited. My father, when I was, I think, 12 or 13 years old, decided he wanted to go and see the house again. And so we went there. So I've seen the house, which is good because it was demolished later on.
You saw it from the inside or only the outside?
No, we were invited by the people who lived there for Torte und Schlagsahne and coffee in the garden.
Yeah. What did it feel like to be in the house of your grandparents?
Well, I knew it was very important for my father, and I knew I had to really be on my best behavior. And to my utter dismay, when the Tochter came out, there was a pineapple cake, and I could not eat pineapple. I hated pineapple. It made me sick. The smell of it was bad enough, but to have it in my mouth was impossible. And I thought, well, this is a very important thing for my father. I can't refuse the cake. That would not be polite. And my parents, who knew I didn't like pineapple, forgot about that, didn't intervene. So I did the only thing I could think of, which was to eat it. And for the first time in my life, I enjoyed pineapple. That's a strange story, which one can interpret as one wishes.
For your father, let's come back to your father. It was very emotional to be there. Did you see like any reaction in his face?
No. The only time I saw any reaction of an emotional kind in my father's face was when we were in Israel and we went to the
Yad Vashem.
The Yad Vashem. Thank you. And there's this huge wall-to-wall picture of Auschwitz. And I saw my father desperately looking at every single person in the picture. And I realized he was looking for his parents and his sister. And that's the only time I had seen any kind of emotion in the face of my father.
Let's come back to your grandparents again. They lived in Langenfeld and they had to move to Cologne. But apparently they were very well known in Langenfeld and they were even in touch with the mayor. And I think he treated his children, as far as I know.
That's right.
Could you explain a little bit about what it meant to have this family in Immichrath, Langenfeld, as citizens?
Well, I went from a position of knowing nothing to a position of knowing at least a little. And what I discovered was that the Tzadi family in Immichrath was very involved in local life. As you say, my grandfather Hugo was a pediatrician, and he did as patients the children of the mayor. The mayor, I think, was a very good man. He had building projects where he wanted to accommodate people who didn't have much money, the poor of Immichrath and Langenfeld. And I got the very strong impression that my grandfather was a very, very popular doctor, and that the family was a well-known family in the local community. And that is very comforting for me, to actually have some kind of insight, however small it is, into the family unit that was there, that I was not allowed to know about. But the not being allowed, I don't hold against my father, because I understand why this had to be taboo. So,
and he had a very important job. I mean, he helped people, so he was very doing reasonable things.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And he not only worked in his own practice, which was in the house on Solingerstrasse, but he also worked in the Rechat Hospital, and he wrote a lot for the medical journals at the time. So he was, he was probably a very good doctor. And, something that I think about and which I write about in the book, which was when they were finally deported to Łódź, or Lodz in Poland, and the...
Before they had to move to Cologne, right?
That was where they were sent from Cologne, yeah. They were forcibly moved from Immichrath. My grandfather was only allowed to work for Jews, so he worked in the Jewish hospital, which was where his daughter, Ursula, worked. And that was thanks to Ursula that he got the job in the Jewish hospital of Cologne. From there, in 1941 or 42, I can't remember, they were sent to the ghetto in Lodz. And one thing that I think about a lot, the Judenrat leader, the man called Rumkowski, in one of the more famous speeches that he made in the ghetto, he said, "Give me your children, because he had been instructed to round up children and elderly people to be sent to Chunno, which was a camp where people were killed with exhaust fumes. And so Rumkowski makes this speech and he says, "Give me your children." And my grandfather, who had spent his life as a doctor for children, was being told that the children in the ghetto were going to be eliminated, and the elderly people. And it's very interesting because I didn't find very much in the archives of Lodz, but I did find certificates signed both by my aunt and my grandfather, and each one of them says that the person is incapacitated and cannot be moved. And I'm sure this was to avoid them being deported. But for a children's doctor to hear that the children of the ghetto must be rounded up, and the way that Rumkowski managed to do this, because it actually happened, was that he excused the Jewish police force in the ghetto. He said, "Your children are okay. We won't take your children." So the only children who were taken were the other children. So the Jewish police, it was easier for them to do the roundup.
Can you explain roundup?
To gather together the elderly and the children to be sent to the extermination camp in Chunno.
So he tried to help somehow or to do something for the children?
Well, I don't know how much medical work he did in the ghetto with children, because there was absolutely no documentation about this. But knowing that he'd spent his working life as a doctor mainly working with children, I just imagine his reaction to that speech by Rumkowski.
In Langenfeld, in Langenfeld, they try to do a lot of things to keep up the Erinnerungskultur. And they even have a street named after your grandfather, Hugozade. What do you think about all this engagement?
Well, it's good that these things have been done.
In Stolpersteine, in Cologne, and even in Langenfeld.
Yes. I mean, I went to Cologne. I visited the Jewish hospital because I wanted to see where they lived and worked. And at the same time, I saw the Stolpersteine. The fact that there's a street named after Hugo, I find that very good. There was a project in a hospital in Reichstadt to have a memorial for my grandfather, but apparently that never happened.
Yeah, there was something in the corona times. They just, I don't know why, but they didn't follow it up. So I don't know. We have to inquire about it.
Yes, I mean, it would be good if there were a memorial in the hospital where he worked. That would be wonderful. Yeah. But yes, to answer your question, the fact that the memory is not lost is very important.
In general.
Yes, absolutely.
So what do you think? Your grandparents are from Germany. They lived in Germany. And how important is it for the Germans to speak about this time and what happened? And do we have to do more about it?
I don't know. I don't like defining people in terms of groups, in terms of nationality, because I think that is placing a limitation, and it, in a way, it is kind of negating our common humanity. I prefer to think of people as individuals rather than as being German or French and so on. And I resist very strongly, people say, "Oh yes, Poland is an anti-Semitic country." There's no such thing as an anti-Semitic country. There are anti-Semites in Poland, but there are anti-Semites everywhere. And more importantly, there are racists everywhere. And anti-Semitism is no different. It's a form of racism. So I certainly don't think that people in Germany today should feel any guilt about what happened in the 1930s. I think that's probably, you know, psychologically not a good thing. I think we should spend more time thinking about the future and, you know, how we can avoid these things happening, which, of course, in a way is nonsense because they always have happened and they probably always will. But at least trying to understand. And I think that to get to the heart of the matter, one has to forget boundaries. It's vital. It's very, very important.
Anti-Semitism is apparently coming up everywhere in the world. And Germany is very special about this topic. And we have this concerning politics. It's not very easy sometimes to have a certain attitude towards things going on in the world, especially in the, let's say what is happening in Israel, Gaza and Syria, all of these countries around. So what do you think, what kind of attitude should we have concerning this aspect? Like, we always have these guilt and say this should never happen again. To plan and have a good future, what should we not think?
Well, I think Germany is rather like me.
Like you.
Yes, because I inherited the guilt that my father felt. And there's this feeling in Germany, I'm not quite sure what Germany means, but there is very clearly a feeling that what happened was a total catastrophe. And obviously it was a total catastrophe. But for this to produce a feeling of guilt in individual German people doesn't make sense to me. It's very difficult because we have this tendency to see the world in a kind of stereotype vision, that we see people as belonging to this group or that group, and that might be religious, it might be cultural, it might be to do with nationalism. And yet, this is not how we should look at people. And I do believe that the crux of the matter is to do with dehumanizing. I make a parallel between what happened in Germany in the 1930s and what is happening in Israel today, because the Germans were, the German Jews, or Jews in general, were defined as a group, not as individuals. And all these Jewish people, they were rich, they exploited, they were the nasty middle-aged Jewish men would seduce children and so on and so forth. Now, to me, that kind of caricature and dehumanization is exactly the same as the idea that all Palestinians are terrorists. Again, we are making judgments not about people, but about a group, and they are misinformed. And I think the only way forward is that we stop thinking in these terms. But how do you do that?
You know, we are all human beings.
That's the basic thing, yes. And we're all frail. We all have our own violence. We have different ways of coping with it. And of course, the other problem is political exploitation. And I think there is a political exploitation of the Shoah in Israeli politics. You know, you cannot criticize us because of what we have suffered. And that's bullshit.
If you could say something to the people from Langenfeld, what kind of message would you give to them? And what kind of message would you give, let's say, young people?
I would like to say that had things turned out differently, I might have lived in Langenfeld. Though that's not sure, of course. So Langenfeld has an important place in my heart. And I would say to the young people of Langenfeld, as I would say to young people all over the world, think about human beings, don't think about stereotypes.
What do you think that so many people in Langenfeld try to give your family a name? What do you think about it?
If I hadn't written a book, I would not have been in touch with Gunther Schmitz. You would not have heard about me, and so on and so forth. And now, even more things. There's the signature plate. Now there's artwork by my grandmother. I mean, I think this is wonderful. I had to start the ball rolling, and it's still rolling. And that's fantastic.
And it makes people visible.
And it makes people visible, absolutely. Yes, yes. And that's what it's all about.
Step out of the silence.
Yes, exactly.
Stop the silence somehow.
Well, there are different kinds of silence. Silence can be wonderful. That silence when a piece of music comes to an end. And I appreciate very much when the conductor, if it's an orchestra, doesn't lower his baton right away. He lets the silence surround the music. So there are silences that are uncomfortable. There is silence that can be meditation, that can in a way be cleansing. There are silences which are imposed. You're not allowed to know this or that or whatever. And my feeling is very much that in breaking the taboo in the family, we don't talk about this, looking for whatever I could find concerning this family instead of just brooding on Auschwitz, that more and more I'm appreciating silence when silence is restorative, when it's good, when it's beneficial. And I don't feel that everything has changed, because that would be impossible. But I feel that my perspectives concerning my family have shifted and have become, shall we say, positive more than negative, that I no longer need to define myself as being a Jew of German origin in a family that perished in Auschwitz. I don't anymore define myself in that way. So there has been a liberation in that sense. And I don't think I could have got there if I had not written my book.
Martha would be proud of you.
I don't know, but it's a nice thought.
This was the podcast Kultur im Ohr with Viola Greifenstein and my guest Stephen Sade, who, at the age of 82, wrote a book about his Jewish family from Langenfeld im Michrath, giving each and every one of them a voice. If you would like to learn more about Stephen Sade, you can find further information in my show notes. Thank you very much for listening.